Chapter 3. The Survivor. As usual, Chief Inspector George Lestrade wakes before everyone else. It goes with the job. When there's a major investigation, he'll be pleasantly surprised if he can manage 4 nights of uninterrupted sleep in a row. And even without the jangle of the telephone and some junior asking him for advice, a random thought will intrude on his subconscious, an idea, a clue, and nudge him awake. The result is that deep sleep is something he has almost forgotten, and he will snap to alertness at the slightest sound. This time it's the wild foxes, screaming in the square below, fighting over food. They should make less noise if they don't want to end up as food themselves. These days, any wild animal is, in every sense, game. The watery light tells him that dawn is just breaking, but he knows from experience that there's no point lying there anymore, pulling the covers over his head, pretending he can nod off again. It's all the more annoying because there's no need for him to go to work until midday. Things are quiet, and anyway, Hopkins is there, manning the fort. So he decides to make himself a quiet cup of tea, and then go out and get some breakfast for Effie and Ollie. They deserve it after last night. Ollie was so brave, as always. Not a word of complaint about being prodded and poked, stuck with needles and attached to noisy machines while they transfused him, just as the hospital porter they picked up said they would. Afterwards, he was so alert and full of energy that he seemed a different boy, chattering and giggling like any healthy 8-year-old, and devouring the fish and chips they picked up on the way home as if he hadn't eaten in a year. Lestrade gets up. He pads out of the bedroom, closing the door behind him so the kettle doesn't wake Effie. His son is sleeping peacefully in the little blue room at the back of the house. Lestrade looks in before he goes downstairs and sees that his son's cheek, squashed against the pillow, has a healthy colour. His breathing is deep and regular. Lestrade gently kisses his son's forehead and goes out to the kitchen. Once the kettle is boiled, Lestrade drinks his tea standing by the tall bay window that looks out over the square. He stopped smoking 5 years ago. But this is the moment he's always tempted once again to light up. He watches the morning light become stronger, hardening the shadows of the railings and the trees. In the center of the square is a bent mulberry, held up by props since a lightning strike in the October storm split its trunk in two. New shoots have sprouted from the wound, and in a good year, there may even be some fruit. Lestrade feels an odd sense of optimism every time the first berries appear on the branches. If this torn and mutilated tree can heal itself, then perhaps London can somehow do the same. And Ollie too. Life is constantly surprising. Effie was angry with him last night for stopping the ambulance, risking Ollie's life for the sake of a stranger. Maybe she was right. The injured man looked like a hopeless cause and he's probably in the morgue by now. But you have to keep trying, even when the odds are stacked against you. That's what being a London police officer teaches you. It's a harsh lesson, and for every success there might be 100 failures, but those little successes are precious, like the tiny mulberries glinting among the dark leaves. His eye is caught by a figure lurking in the shadows. This house was once owned by a drug dealer, but following the controversial Criminal Compensation Act, 2039, it was confiscated when the man was jailed and given to the Metropolitan Police to be rented out at a much reduced rent. Strange that a drug dealer should have chosen to live somewhere so homely, in a 3-story Georgian house complete with bay windows, arbor, and small back garden. Lestrade knows how lucky he was to have it assigned to him when he was promoted to Chief Inspector. There's just one problem. Occasionally, former clients who have been out of the loop for a while, thanks to prison or an abortive attempt to get clean, will turn up hoping for a fix. Effie has grown tired of opening the door to supplicants with eyes full of need and pain. Is the man in the square one of them? But it's all right. As he steps out of the shadows, Lestrade recognizes the local street cleaner, a scarf wrapped 3 times around his scrawny neck, as it always is in both the winter and summer months. The cleaner grinds his morning cigarette out under his boot, rather defeating the purpose of what he's paid to do, and walks over to the refuse trolley parked on the pavement. As he lifts the handles, he glances up at the window, and Lestrade raises his hand in greeting. The man nods and wheels the trolley away. For a while after he has passed out of sight, Lestrade can hear the squeak of the wheels. and there's nothing but birdsong. A glance at his watch tells him it's just past six. There's a bakery run by two plump, ever-smiling sisters. It's on the far corner of the square. Their cinnamon buns, the house speciality, will just be coming out of the oven, warm and fragrant. Lestrade dresses quietly and is about to let himself out of the flat when his mobile phone rings. Hurrying across to the windowsill, the only place in the building where there's a decent signal, he snatches it up. Lestrade? Sorry to disturb you, sir. The crackly voice is that of his young inspector. Lestrade's heart sinks. Hopkins, what is it? You didn't hear it? What hasn't he heard? What could be important enough to call him at dawn? There's been a plane crash. What has that got to do with him? Planes don't land in London. If you're rich enough to fly, you're smart enough to stay well clear of this city. It came down in Richmond Park, Hopkins tells him. There was a massive fireball. Richmond? Any survivors? No chance, sir. And worse than that, you've got all those homeless people camping out on the common. The plane ploughed through Tent City. God knows how many of them were taken out in the blast. There are probably close to 300 casualties in all. 300? Good God. I presume the fire service are there? Yes, and I've sent uniforms down to secure the site. So there's not much we can do, then? I suppose not, sir. And I'm sorry if I've woken you up for nothing, but the AAIB have taken charge and I was thinking of showing my face. The AAIB. Air Accident Investigations Bureau. Blank-faced men and women in suits going about their business with officious distaste. They're based in Harpenden and are more used to studying blips on a computer screen than bodies in a field. They have a low opinion of policemen running round in uniforms that have barely changed in 200 years, still believing that they can do anything about the soaring crime figures. Crime is out of control. The city is out of control. And control is all the AAIB care about. Suddenly Lestrade understands why Hopkins has called him. And of course the young officer is right. Richmond Park is part of his patch. The homeless people, even if they have no jobs, no possessions, no future, are his problem. The AAIB will turn them into a statistic. Lestrade won't let that happen. Okay, you'd better pick me up. Yes, sir. I'll be with you in 15 minutes or so. He hangs up and sighs. No time for buns now. Who is that? Effie comes into the room, rubbing her eyes. Lestrade always thinks she is at her most beautiful when she has just woken up, with her crumpled hair, her soft hazel eyes, her cheeks still pink from the warmth of the bed. She seems almost childlike, and he remembers how young she was when they first met all those years ago. He was a detective superintendent. She taught in a primary school. In those first days, she was fascinated, almost in awe of his work. But after they married, and particularly when Ollie arrived, that all changed. Ask any married policeman. Home and work never mix. They don't even come close. It was Hopkins. Isn't it a bit early to be calling? She stretches, revealing a sliver of brown stomach traced with a filigree of stretch marks. She was tiny when she got pregnant, weighed down by the enormous bump that was Ollie. It was a difficult birth. And with all the illness, Ollie has been difficult ever since. There's been a plane crash in Richmond. She freezes mid-stretch and her hands drop to her sides. I heard you say 300. Is that how many were killed? It was just an accident. There's nothing much I can do, but a lot of homeless people have been killed along with the passengers, so I'm going to have to put in an appearance. It's a nuisance. I was just on the way to get breakfast. She comes over to him and kisses him gently on the cheek. Don't worry. I've got eggs for Ollie when he wakes up. She smiles. You always say that. What? It's a nuisance. Do I? It's a nuisance when someone is stabbed to death, when a woman is found floating in the river, when someone turns up missing their head. Sometimes I think your whole life is spent chasing nuisances. These are all cases that he has investigated in the past month. Is she teasing him? Or is there something more serious in what she's trying to say? With Effie, you can never be sure. Hopkins is going to be here any minute, Lestrade says. I don't want him disturbing Ollie with the doorbell. I'll wait for him outside. Try not to be late tonight, Susanna and Michael are coming for supper. Susanna is Effie's sister, up from the coast for a couple of days. Michael, her bad-tempered husband, has the look of someone who's always on the wrong side of the law. He's the foreman at a plant recycling shipping containers. Effie knows Lestrade doesn't get on with either of them. "I'll make sure I'm back in plenty of time," he assures her. He goes down and lets himself out of the main door of the building. Last night's fog has blown away and the air is fresh and cold. A few minutes later, a carriage comes trundling into the square. It pulls in at the curb, and D.I. Stanley Hopkins opens the door for him.
"Morning, sir."
"Morning." Lestrade throws a last glance up at the window. Standing at the window with a shawl she has pulled round her shoulders, Effie raises her hand. He mirrors it with his own before climbing inside the carriage. The driver clicks the horses on and they pass out of the square and onto Kennington Park Road. A few Londoners are already out. The street sweepers, the wagons delivering milk and fresh bread, night workers returning home from their shifts. Hopkins is uncharacteristically silent, gazing out of the window without actually taking in the view.
"Something the matter, Hopkins?" Lestrade asks him.
"Yes, sir." The young officer turns back. Lestrade can see the bad news in his eyes before he speaks it. It's obvious that Hopkins hasn't been in the police quite long enough yet. He hasn't learned how to hide his feelings.
"I didn't want to have to tell you first thing in the morning, but
you'll have to know eventually. It's Nelson." The detective sergeant. Female, ambitious, in her 30s. She was reporting directly to Lestrade, and that makes it worse. He knows her well, like all his men and women.
"She's dead?"
"Yes, sir. She was pulled out of the Regent's Park Canal last night."
"Oh, God. This is exactly what I was afraid of."
"I know, sir. I'm sorry." The Chief Superintendent, Lestrade's senior officer, is retiring soon and wants to go out with a bang. One last medal on his chest to protect his legacy and to make sure he isn't forgotten 5 minutes after he leaves the building. And how is he going to achieve this? A month ago, he decided to put someone inside the Bohemia Club to gather enough information to get the place shut down. How much more out of touch could he be, sitting in the ivory tower of his office on the top floor of New Scotland Yard? No undercover agent would last 5 minutes in the Bohemia Club, the meeting point of every thread in the spider's web that is London's criminal underworld. And what sort of information did they think they were going to overhear? Picking up a snatch of useful gossip would be like wandering into the Bank of England, expecting to find a few loose £5 notes on the floor. These things didn't happen. Lestrade had tried to talk his boss out of it. He had warned him about past attempts to infiltrate the club. They had always ended in abject failure and either hospitalization or death. Bohemia was a law unto itself, and the first rule couldn't be simpler. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Blithely, the chief superintendent had ignored it. What sickened Lestrade most was that he had managed to persuade Kate Nelson to volunteer. Of course, women had to work that little bit harder to get promotion. There were so few of them in the force these days. You could imagine how flattered she would have been to be chosen by the most senior man in the building. She would have seen it as her big break. And this was her reward, just for wanting to succeed.
"Who's handling the investigation?" Lestrade asks, wearily.
"McKinnon, sir." D.I. McKinnon is a good man. He'll know how to deal with it. He'll ask the right questions and make sure he doesn't ruffle too many feathers. He won't expect any answers.
"It's a damn shame, Hopkins.
Nelson was single, is that right?"
"Yes, sir. No children or anything like that. I suppose that's a blessing."
He pauses.
"There's an elderly mother, though. They were living together."
"We'll see what we can do for her." The police still run a benevolence fund. If the chief superintendent has any sense of shame, he'll release enough money to look after the old woman. Now it's Lestrade who turns away and stares out into the street. He had known what would happen. Perhaps he should have tried harder to prevent it. The journey west proceeds in silence, but after a while Lestrade notices that the morning seems to be becoming darker, not brighter. Wiping the condensation off the window, he stares. Black smoke has blotted out the dawn, like ink in water. There's an acrid smell in the air, burned plastic and aviation fuel, and something far worse.
The only sounds are the clip of the horse's hooves as the carriage passes through the rusting gates and into Richmond Park. But a few yards up the track, it comes to a stuttering halt. Lestrade opens the door to find that the driver has climbed down and is standing with his hat in his hand, mouth open. The two police officers get out, and they all stare at the scene before them. On the other side of a fluttering cordon, a black claw mark has been gouged through the park, leaving a trail of utter devastation. There are sheets of torn metal and contorted lumps of melted plastic. Paper and scraps of fabric roll across the scorched grass, and the surrounding tree trunks are splintered, their severed crowns lying nearby, blackened and leafless. The eerie silence is broken only by the huffing and fidgeting of the horses, and through it all, wisps of smoke drift like bewildered phantoms.
Bloody hell, the driver breathes.
He is blinking rapidly as if trying to erase the scene. That's exactly what it is, Lestrade thinks. Hell has certainly come to Richmond Park. Thank you, driver, is what he says, pressing the fare into the man's hand. You'd better get out of here. The man needs no persuading. He climbs back up into the cab and turns the horses around. Lestrade takes a breath. Ready? He asks Hopkins. This is far outside their experience. Both men have been to murder scenes, but this is more like a murder panorama. Grim-faced, Hopkins nods, and they set off towards the fluttering cordon. The burnt grass crackles underfoot as they walk along the blackened path, littered with increasing evidence of the plane's grisly fate. It takes a moment for Lestrade to recognize a twisted hunk of metal as one of the turbine engines. Fluttering around it are burnt rags of brightly colored nylon. Tents, Hopkins murmurs. There'll have been a whole family sleeping in some of them. Poor bastards, didn't stand the chance. The smoke is thickening, making Lestrade's eyes stream, but he's almost grateful for that as it blurs the images they are now passing. Suitcases spilling brightly colored clothes, broken pieces of metal and plastic twisted out of shape, whole perfect seats with charred figures still gripping the armrests. Jesus, Hopkins murmurs. Lestrade rubs his eyes and examines what's left of the plane. She lies broken on her side, like some magnificent beast brought down and mutilated by poachers. Both wings have been torn off and rest on the scorched grass some distance from the cabin. The aileron on the left wing is raised, like a broken feather. From the severed tail, proudly emblazoned with the green and gold ribbons of Eastern Airlines, wires and tubes dangle. The fuselage is split in half, spilling its insides, and smoke bleeds from the black eye sockets of the cockpit. What do you reckon? Hopkins says softly. A bomb? I don't think so. A bomb would have blown the fuselage apart. The engines are so damaged, maybe the fire started there. System failure, then, Hopkins says. Or pilot error. Figures in white overalls are moving back and forth across the cratered landscape. A few of them carry pieces of wreckage, some large enough to need two people. Others have suitcases, wooden crates, documents, blankets. One man walks past with an oversized teddy bear under his arm. Its left eye has melted. They take the items across to an area with a separate cordon and lay them down beside sheet-covered bundles. A number of large white tents, canvas offices, have been set up behind the cordoned-off area. Lights blaze out of the plastic windows, and arc lamps have been set up all around, vaguely sinister in the smoke and unnatural darkness. As Lestrade and Hopkins approach, a burly man in a white hazmat suit, his face completely shrouded, steps in front of them, blocking their way. There is no entry here, the man says. And who are you? Lestrade counters. AAIB. That's not what he asked. Hopkins steps forward, automatically going to the defense of his superior officer. He has a short fuse and it's just been lit. But it doesn't make any difference, he goes on, because he's Chief Inspector Lestrade, and if you're going to prevent us from carrying out our duties, you're going to be AAIJ, which stands for Arrested and in Jail. Do you understand?
I'm only doing what I've been told. The man murmurs, but steps back to let them pass. The two policemen approach the tent, but they don't go in. The flap of the door is open, and Lestrade can see four or five figures surrounding a wide trestle table with a solid-looking piece of kit plugged into a laptop, which in turn is connected to a speaker. Lestrade knows at once that this is the black box that has been recovered from the plane. The AAIB people are listening to the last moments of Eastern Airlines Flight 356. A crackly voice emerges from the speaker. East Flight 356 Alpha, this is Heathrow. Keep straight, heading 290 degrees. Maintain altitude 3,000 feet. You are cleared for the ILS. Approach runway 26, left. Lestrade is separated from the scene on the other side of the canvas. He can't ask the assembled experts what they are thinking, but he knows that he is listening to Heathrow Air Traffic Control. A calm male voice replies, Left 290, clear ILS, 26 left, East Flight 356 Alpha. It's the pilot. There are a few seconds of silence, then one of the women in the tent says, What's that noise? None of the AAIB people move, all of them straining their ears. And now Lestrade can hear it too, a faint mechanical wailing. The left engine's overheating, the pilot says. Shut it down and take over manually. The instruction comes from Heathrow. There's a brief pause, then the pilot speaks again. I can't. The autopilot's turned us off the fly path and now it's not responding. He speaks more quietly, addressing the co-pilot sitting next to him. Any luck? Nothing. Replies a woman's voice, then, Wait, the right engine's doing the same. A pause, then the pilot speaks again, fighting to keep the panic out of his voice. The engine's on fire. I can see the flames out of the window. Like a howling of distant wind, Lestrade begins to hear the passengers screaming. Raising his voice over them, the pilot speaks again. This is East Flight 356 Alpha requesting permission for an emergency landing. Flight 356 Alpha, why are you turning?
I'm not doing anything. It's the autopilot.
Maintain altitude. We have you descending at a critical angle.
I don't know what's happening.
Now comes the robotic voice of the automatic warning system, composed but urgent. Terrain ahead. Pull up.
Mayday, the pilot cries. Mayday.
Pull up. Pull up. Pull up.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The sound of screaming goes on for three interminable seconds before the recording cuts off in a burst of static.
Poor bastards, Hopkins mutters in the silence.
Lestrade shivers. All those people. They must have known. For those few seconds, they must have known they were going to die. He's been out in the cold long enough. He walks into the tent, Hopkins right beside him. The four men and women see them enter, and one reaches out and closes the laptop, ending the playback. Immediately there is a sense of confrontation inside the white canvas. Them and us. The AAIB people have closed ranks. Two men, two women. All in their 30s, defined by their white coats. One of the men has a beard. The other has covered the lower part of his face with a mask. Is he frightened of what he might breathe in, or is he concealing his identity? They are surrounded by mobile phones, radio sets, ledgers, and electronic devices whose functions can only be guessed at. Lestrade can't help wondering why the AAIB should be so well equipped when he and his men have almost nothing. Imagine what they could achieve with some decent tech, instead of plastic biros, wire notepads, and Rolodexes. A woman steps forward. She has short grey hair, a small mouth. Her eyes behind plastic-framed spectacles are unfriendly. Can I help you? Lestrade introduces himself, and he and Hopkins show ID. This does nothing to warm the atmosphere inside the tent. I'm Dr. Nemal, she explains, but does not say what she is a doctor of. I'm heading the AAIB investigation. This is a terrible tragedy. She adds this almost as an afterthought. But with respect, Chief Inspector Lestrade, I wouldn't have said it was a matter for the Metropolitan Police.
That depends on what caused the crash, Lestrade says. Looks like quite a few of our citizens died.
Nemor looks him over. Lestrade stands there patiently, waiting for her to judge him. She assesses his height and girth, his tired eyes, his cheap suit. Just one more doltish middle-aged policeman. No threat. It's funny how so many of the agencies working in and around London have a low opinion of Scotland Yard. "We've examined the flight data recorder," she says finally. "The plane was on its way to New York, but the pilot experienced difficulties and requested a diversion to Heathrow."
"What difficulties?"
"He wasn't specific. It was a technical issue, nothing serious, at least not at first. He was given permission to proceed, and to start with, everything's normal. The appropriate speed and altitude to start the descent into Heathrow. And then, as far as we can tell, there's a huge fuel injection. The heat in jet engines is so high that any excess fuel will spontaneously combust, so both engines catch fire. At this point, the pilot attempts to take over from the autopilot, presumably to attempt an emergency landing, but the control surfaces don't obey his instructions."
"Control surfaces?" Hopkins asks.
"The elevators, ailerons, rudders and flaps."
Now she's a schoolteacher, talking to a child who can't keep up.
"The things that make it turn and go up and down."
Lestrade remembers the broken feather on the wingtip. "Then what? It just drops out of the sky?" Hopkins says.
"Yes."
"So the autopilot malfunctioned?"
"That's what we believe."
The bearded man takes over, trying to be a little more emollient. "Obviously, there are a great many factors we have to take into consideration, and the minutes immediately after a major event such as this are extremely valuable. That's why we've set up here, close to the crash site. We'll give you all the information you need, the results of our findings, but with the greatest respect, officer, right now we're wasting time. Would you be offended if I asked you to leave and let us get on with our job?" Hopkins is looking at the investigations officer with narrowed eyes. But Lestrade isn't offended. More intrigued as to what it is the AAIB doesn't want the Metropolitan Police to know about this crash. "We wouldn't want to get in your way," he says. "But there is just one more thing. This was an Eastern Airlines flight en route from Paris to New York. Can you let us have a full passenger list?"
"Of course."
"And the registered flight path?" The bearded man is puzzled.
"Why?"
"Why not?" He realizes there's no point arguing.
"I'll have it sent to you."
"Thank you." Moments later, Lestrade and Hopkins are outside. Hopkins looks at his superior quizzically. "They weren't going to tell us anything," Lestrade says.
"They're hiding something," Hopkins agrees.
Lestrade nods.
"There wasn't a malfunction. You heard what the pilot said. The plane didn't just wander off course. It turned off the flight path.
Paris to New York. Shouldn't even have been flying over London. Someone took over the controls. This wasn't an accident. It was an act of terrorism."
"But how is that even possible?"
"That's what they're not telling us." Lestrade stops and takes in the crash scene. The morning light has broken through at last, but that only makes it worse. The mangled wreckage still smoking. The ripped up earth and trees, all that death. He moves forward. "The CEO of Eastern Airlines has an office in London," he mutters. "Let's see what he has to say." 9 miles away, on the other side of the city, John is treating himself to a gloriously unhealthy breakfast in a local cafe. Scrambled egg, bacon, fried bread, grilled tomatoes, baked beans, and a cochineal-coloured sausage whose provenance he doesn't want to think about. For once he has an appetite, so much so that he asks the waitress for a couple of extra rounds of toast. He slept well, and woke feeling as close to refreshed as it is possible to be, with at least one glass of whiskey too many in his system. The air in this part of town is not great either. Perhaps he should move, he thinks, as he pays the waitress and puts his coat on. Find lodgings further away from the fumes of the river. Leaving a shilling tip on the blue formica tabletop, he steps out into the cold morning and sets off for the hospital at a brisk walk. Maybe when they find out how well he patched up Sherlock Holmes, for some reason he finds the name is becoming familiar, they will give him a pay rise, and he'll be able to afford more than one room. A bathroom of his own, perhaps. Or a separate living room where he can invite people for supper. Like Missy Hudson.
He indulges the fantasy as he passes down Horsefree Road. The powers that be at St. Thomas's will be astonished at his success against all the odds. They will look at his record and realize their mistake. In reality, he should be employed as a consultant, not a porter. He will be invited to join the Royal College of Surgeons and will attend their annual dinners with Nurse Hudson on his arm. People will come to ask advice about cardiac angioplasty, not to ask him to make beds and carry bodies to the morgue. With his mind pleasantly occupied, the journey passes quickly, and only as the great slab of the hospital building rises up in front of him does his confidence falter. Mr. Holmes was very badly injured. With only a handful of efficacious antibiotics left, an infection will almost certainly be fatal. And if he manages to dodge that bullet, there's the risk of epilepsy, of blood clots, of seizures, all of which could kill him. What if the head trauma caused a deeper bleed in the brain and he has a stroke? He could be left paralyzed, brain damaged. He might curse John for saving him. By the time he walked through the doors of the hospital, John's good mood has evaporated. It's approaching 8 o'clock when the night shift finishes, and the receptionist already has a coat on. That means Missy's shift will be ending too, if she hasn't already gone. John hurries to the lift, and by the time he emerges onto the hushed corridor of the fourth floor, his heart is in his mouth. The grey lino stretches out in front of him, past the recovery rooms, to the door of Operating Theatre 6, where John performed his first surgery in 3 years. If it was a success, Mr. Holmes will be in one of the recovery rooms. If not, he walks down the corridor. The only sounds are the ticking of the clock on the wall and the single distant scream of a woman in pain. There's a very old man in the first room. In the second lies a woman connected to a series of tubes. Perhaps she was the one who screamed. The occupant of the third room has a sheet pulled over its head. John enters the room and lifts it. It's not Mr. Holmes. He has just stepped back into the corridor when the door of Operating Theatre 6 opens and Nurse Hudson steps out, holding a towel. Missy! John stops himself. He can tell immediately from the look in her eyes that something terrible has happened. I was waiting for you to come. She looks exhausted. She has been here all night, of course, but there's clearly something else. Is he dead? It was what John was expecting. He curses himself now, sitting in the cafe, celebrating with that extravagant breakfast. She can't seem to find the words. Something's happened, she stammers finally. John nods, accepting the worst. Missy is holding the door open, her eyes glittering feverishly. She wants him to see for himself. As he walks towards the door, he can hear faint sounds from within. A sort of metallic tapping and the occasional rustle. Is the man having a seizure? He inhales deeply, then steps over the threshold. Mr. Holmes is sitting up in bed, spooning custard from a bowl and reading a copy of the London Inquirer. Did you know, he says, without looking up, that 9 UFOs have been seen over London in the past year alone? No, John says carefully. Is he delirious? I did not. He moves closer to the bed. Holmes has a fresh bandage around his head, but apart from that, there is no evidence that he is recovering from a serious operation. Nor are there any signs of fever or infection. John reaches for the thermometer on the equipment table, but as he does so, Missy's hand closes on his arm and she murmurs, "Believe me, I've checked everything several times over." 3 of them were obviously high-altitude military aircraft, Holmes continues. 5 have a suspiciously close resemblance to spacecraft depicted in films, and the only original and apparently inexplicable sighting was made by a heavy user of psychedelic drugs. You can tell by his eyes. Look. He holds up the magazine. My name is John Watson, John says. I operated on you. The man looks at him. Why? You're not a doctor. Oh, but you were in the military, so it's possible you were a battlefield medic. Indeed I was. He smiles at Missy. She must have been trying to reassure Mr. Holmes. Missy mouths, I didn't tell him. You didn't need to. Mr. Holmes smiles, his bright gaze passing between them. Your haircut was the first clue, and then there's the permanent suntan gained, I would have said, in the Middle East, plus the fact that although you seem to have fallen on hard times and have a distressingly shabby wardrobe, you still polish your shoes. Missy is blinking as if she's looking into a bright light. John feels like he's about to burst out laughing at the sheer ridiculousness of the whole situation. With a head injury like that, this man should be drifting in and out of consciousness, if not comatose, if not dead. He manages to collect himself.
"You had quite a bump on the head," he says. "How are you feeling?"
"I do have a slight headache."
Now John does laugh. Missy joins in, and the expression on Holmes's face as he looks between them only makes them laugh all the harder. John has seen some incredible recoveries of the youngest and fittest members of his troop, but with an injury like this, even they would be experiencing more than a slight headache. It's a miracle. He and Missy have performed a miracle. Gesturing to the bowl of custard, John says, "I see you've managed some breakfast. That's a good sign."
"Two breakfasts," Missy tells him, "and that wasn't enough, so I got him some custard from the kitchen."
"Tinned," Holmes remarks. And then, before John can say any more, the door opens and a man appears, walking in as if he owns the place, which, in a sense, he does. Mr. Costello is the senior consultant at the hospital. A cardiac surgeon in his 60s with an entire alphabet after his name, his expensive-looking dove grey suit is cut to accentuate his impressive height and bulk. His grey hair is slicked back with impeccable neatness, and his black brogues flash like mirrors. In the sudden silence, the ticking of the gold watch hanging from his waistcoat sounds like tutting. John and Missy compose themselves immediately. "Good morning, Mr. Costello." He ignores them and instead addresses a figure behind his back.
"Adalji, I thought you said this room was free."
George Adalji comes through the doorway. There are dark rings under his eyes, and his wispy hair is plastered to his scalp with perspiration. It's clearly been a long night.
"It wasn't assigned," he says, then catches sight of John and Missy over his superior's shoulder.
"John? What's going on?"
"Well..." John isn't sure where to begin. But in fact, he's not going to be given the chance.
"We can't have this, Adalji," the consultant snaps. "Hospital protocol must be followed or patients will die."
He strides across the room and snatches the board from the end of Holmes's bed. It provides him with the details of the medical procedures followed, the drugs used, the necessary authorizations. Or it should do. Costello frowns, and his flashing eyes fix on Adalji.
"The PFS hasn't been filled in. Who operated on this man?"
I don't know," stammers George.
"You don't know? But you were the duty doctor last night. It's your job to know."
Adalji glances at the patient, who is languidly stretched out on the bed, observing the scene with an air of amused interest. His eyes snap towards John.
"Is this..."
"Let me explain," John says.
"If you aren't competent to keep this hospital operating smoothly, Adalji," Costello barks, "then perhaps it's time you..."
John cuts in. "I operated on him." There's a stunned silence. A group of nurses has gathered outside the door and they're peering in, their own patients briefly forgotten. "Successfully, as you can see," John continues quickly. "In fact, he's well enough to be taken back to the wards, so I'll just get him out of your way."
"You did what, Porter?"
Mr. Costello says dangerously. The atmosphere in the room has thickened.
I used to be an army doctor, sir, so...
"I told John to take the patient down to the waiting room, Mr. Costello," Adalji interrupts, his stern tone undermined by the tremor in his voice. "It appears Mr. Watson disobeyed my specific instruction. I just felt that there may be a chance of saving him if..."
"Let me get this straight," the consultant says with deadly coldness.
"You, Adalji, misdiagnose a patient who, as it would appear, was likely to make a full recovery and send him to die? You, Porter, take it upon yourself to disobey a direct instruction and, forgive me," he pretends to laugh, "and operate on him? What kind of a bloody circus do you think we're running here?"
Adalji attempts to take his glasses off, but fumbles them, dropping them on the floor. John picks them up, but as he snatches them back, Adalji won't meet his gaze. The consultant rounds on Missy.
And you, nurse, didn't you see fit to inform your superiors that a porter was assaulting a patient?
It was hardly assaulting, sir, John says. We saved his life.
We? You are in on this, nurse?
Missy's mouth opens and closes. There is complete silence but for the rustling of paper. Mr. Holmes has lost interest and gone back to his magazine. When Costello speaks again, his voice is soft.
Get out of my hospital, the pair of you.
But he was going to die if...
I said out. Now, you are fired with immediate effect, and consider yourselves lucky I don't inform the police. Hidalgi, I will want a full report on what has happened here, after which I will be giving some thought to your future in this hospital, too.
Missy's lips are trembling, and she is close to tears as she moves towards the door, her hand gliding across the worktop as if for support.
Wait, John says.
Out!
The consultant roars. Everyone flinches, but John stands his ground.
I made her, he announces, loud enough for everyone to hear. I made Nurse Hudson operate. I said that Dr. Hidalgi had given me permission as we were understaffed. She wanted to check before we began, but I said that if she did, I would report her for endangering a patient.
They are nose to nose. Costello, glaring at him down nostrils, flared with fury, and for a moment John thinks he's going to strike him.
How dare you put one of my nurses in that position?
He hisses. John says nothing. His heart rate is pounding, and he cannot bring himself to look at Missy. Costello turns.
Nurse, discharge this patient, then go about your duties. If there are any repercussions from what has happened to him, you will be answerable to his family.
Yes, Mr. Costello.
Hurrying to the bed, Missy kicks off the brake and pushes Mr. Holmes out of the operating theatre. Costello turns back to John.
You. Out. Now, or I really will call the police.
With a curt nod, John follows Missy from the room, the gaggle of nurses parting to let him through before filing silently into the operating room and closing the door. Missy is almost running to the lift, pushing her patient ahead of her. John catches up with her just as the doors open. They both enter, and John slides the metal grill shut. His hands are shaking so much it takes long seconds for him to line up the bolt with the hole. The lift sets off on its rumbling descent. Missy is breathing heavily, her chest heaving, her lips completely bloodless. It is Mr. Holmes who breaks the silence.
The real reason he was upset was because his dog was sick on his shoe this morning.
John ignores him.
Missy,
Though both shoes had clearly been polished, one of them had a slightly matte finish where the creature's stomach acid had burned the leather. There were other spatters of it on his trousers that he had attempted to sponge away.
Missy, I'm so sorry I got you into that.
Judging by the colour, the creature had probably been eating grass, which could suggest an intestinal parasite.
Mr. Holmes!
John cries in exasperation. The lift reaches the ground floor, and Missy yanks open the gate. Holmes leans on his elbows, gazing at his surroundings as she wheels him towards the entrance hall. Is she intending to follow Costello's instructions and discharge him less than 12 hours after major cranial surgery? That would be madness. Yet there's no denying that Holmes appears to be perfectly well. His eyes are bright, the pupils responding normally as he focuses on a sign, a cleaner, a half-open door. At the end of the corridor, Missy parks the trolley up against the wall and finally turns to face John.
I have things to do. Can I leave it to you to contact his family and discharge him?
Yes, but I'm not sure. He tails off, gazing at her rapidly retreating back. Crossing the entrance hall, she ignores the greeting from Libby, the day receptionist, heads down the opposite corridor, turns a corner, and vanishes.
Why do people keep calling me Holmes?
John turns his attention back to his patient.
That was the name you gave us when you came in. Isn't that your name?
I very much doubt it. That said, it does sound familiar. Could I have said I wanted to go home? I can't really remember.
He sighs.
My thoughts seem very confused.
Hardly surprising, given the seriousness of your injury. Do you have any idea what happened to you?
I was struck from behind and then fell into the river some distance east of where I was found.
Who hit you?
The man's marble brow creases.
If he was behind me, then how would I have been able to see him, or her? But you remember being hit and going into the river?
No.
Then how can you describe where and how you were attacked? John tries to keep the irritation from his voice. Thanks to this man, John is now jobless and Missy is furious with him. The head injury is on the back right side of my head, Holmes continues, so clearly I was struck from behind, probably by someone right-handed. I have been in the river, as is clear from the chemical and organic matter on my skin. He raises an arm, and John can see the faint streaks of green from the filthy Thames water. How do you know it didn't happen where I found you? I saw your attackers. They were not my attackers. I fell from a height, and they were on the ground, which is where you came upon them. That was how they were able to rob me. The tide must have been high, or whoever pulled me out onto the path would not have been able to reach me, therefore the river was coming in and carried my body west until it came to rest where you found me. John finds his irritation morphing to intrigue. So how do you know you were robbed? I seem to have lost all my clothes. I doubt very much that I was naked when I was attacked, so I presume they were taken afterwards by the people you saw. Plus, you don't know my name, so there was nothing with my body to identify me. No apparent brain damage, then. Unless he's a pathological liar and actually knows very well what happened. Okay, well, can you tell me the names of any loved ones so we can contact them and let them know you're okay? The man's frown deepens. I'm having trouble enough recalling my own name, so I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to help you with loved ones or even hated ones, if such a concept exists. This isn't good. If they can't contact his family, what on earth is John going to do with him? Don't worry, John says, trying to sound positive. I'm sure your memory will come back given time. You may not be right about that, Holmes replies, quite matter-of-factly. As you should know, Dr. Watson, retrograde amnesia is just as likely to worsen or remain as it is for life. He's right. The memories may never return, but long-term memories are more likely to be retained. Perhaps John can trigger something by getting him to think about his past. If he can recall anything from his childhood, he might remember his parents. Firstly, I'm not a doctor anymore, so just plain Watson, or John, will do. And secondly, you seem to have retained a lot of information, so there's good reason to be optimistic. Can you remember where you were brought up? Childhood friends. Holmes blinks once, twice. No. Seriously, nothing. Nothing at all. Holmes shakes his head. It's very curious, Watson. My other mental faculties seem to be functioning normally. He concentrates for a moment. I think I may be connected with a person or a place called Diogenes. Diogenes? What makes you think that? I can see the letters. At least I have a memory of seeing them. Diogenes, I'm sure of it. Diogenes was a Greek philosopher. Have you been to Greece? Pote den hexor ten episkepse. John lets this pass. He leans against the footbar of the trolley, letting his head hang down. What is he going to do? He's on the ground floor of a hospital from which he has just been fired, with a patient who has been ordered to leave. Said patient has no home address and quite possibly no home. Doesn't even have a proper name. It's clear that the two of them must part company. John is already regretting that they ever met. There's always the nearest haven. The havens are government-run hostels which offer sanctuary but little in the way of comfort or kindness. They are so austere, and with so many regulations, that most homeless people would rather die of cold than go there. Holmes would be fed and clothed before he's set to work sewing body bags or laundering the soiled sheets of his compatriots. The havens are also riddled with disease. John would have saved Mr. Holmes from fatal head trauma, only for him to die of typhus or cholera or the latest mutant respiratory virus. Either that or dirt will get into the wound and the infection will kill him. The church? One of the gentler denominations who don't advocate redemption through back-breaking labour and endless prayer? They are few and far between these days and their shelters are always overcrowded. Holmes would have to queue up all day to have any hope for a place to be allocated to him by sundown. Might look fit, but is he really capable of standing in the cold for 12 or more hours? John examines him. Holmes is looking at his hand as if it belongs to someone else, scrutinizing the back, the palm, the nails. There is something childlike about him, a wonder and an innocence. Is he even capable of looking after himself? John sighs. There's nothing else for it. I'll have to take Mr. Holmes back to Pimlico.
And since he can't very well travel there in the sheet, which is all he's wearing, John will have to find him some clothes.
He's made a rod for his own back, that's for sure.
Wait here. I'll be 5 minutes. Old clothing belonging to patients who will sadly no longer need it, will be cremated, not buried, is washed and fumigated in the laundry down in the basement of the South Wing. At any other time, he would never consider such a course of action, but Costello has given him no choice. As soon as he steps out into the basement, he can hear the slosh and hum of the machines. Tendrils of soap-fragrant steam creep beneath the laundry doors, and as he approaches, he can see through the misted windows the hazy shapes of the launderers moving about like phantoms. He waits for one of the fuzzy shadows to pass, then opens the door and slips inside. The steam rushes out of the gap, and briefly, it's possible to make out the room clearly. Washing hangs from lines stretched from corner to corner. In the gaps between the items, he can make out bustling figures. One bent over an ironing board, another scrubbing a stain, another folding sheets onto a tottering pile. John freezes, waiting to be spotted, but the steam billows back to hide him. Blindly, he steps forward, arms out. Voices, very close, babble in some Asiatic language. His hands make contact with the laundry. He moves along the line until he comes to a dry pair of trousers, then a shirt and a jacket. As he tugs them down, the pegs clatter onto the tile floor. The voices stop. Bundling the clothes up in his arms, he heads for the door. He only remembers shoes when he sees a line of them arranged against the wall. But the launderers are calling to him now, asking what he's doing. He snatches up the nearest pair and shoulder barges the door. The voices pursue him to the staircase, but he makes it back up to ground without being stopped. Now he can see what he has collected. A rather formal tweed suit, the smart linen shirt, and a pair of brown brogues. He hopes he has picked the right size. At any event, Holmes is going to look far smarter than he does. But Holmes has gone. Panicking, John dashes around the ground floor until finally he discovers him settled in the staff cafe sipping tea. He is wrapped in a sheet, bizarre even in a hospital. Sitting on the leather banquette opposite him is Nurse Hudson. She's laughing, shaking her head in apparent disbelief at something Holmes has said. The laughter cuts off at John's approach. "What's so funny?" he says, smiling. "Nothing," Missy says. "Am I right?" Mr. Holmes says. "Was it cheese on toast?" The smile briefly reappears. "Yes." John says, "I got you some clothes, Mr. Holmes." He bites back his irritation as Holmes examines them, rubbing the fabric between his fingers before finally nodding. "I'll have to do. Go and get dressed. There's a toilet out of the doors and to the left." It doesn't escape John's notice that as Holmes gets up, Missy's eyes widen, partly with embarrassment, but also with admiration. The sheet has fallen away to reveal the shoulders, back, and lower parts of an athlete or classical Greek sculpture. For his part, Holmes is blithely unaware as he leaves the room. John rolls his eyes, then sits down and takes a deep breath. "Missy, I am so sorry for what happened. For getting you into trouble, I should never have asked for your help." She doesn't look at him. He presses on. "I should have just done what Adalji told me in the first place." Now her eyes flash to his.
"What, and let him die?"
John sighs and looks down at his hands.
"Whatever he says, he can't win."
"Has he mentioned a next of kin?" Missy asks.
"No, he can't remember anything."
"So what are you going to do with him?"
"I'll take him back to my lodgings, just until I can trace his family."
"You told me you've only got a single bed. Where will you sleep?"
John considers. "On the floor, I suppose."
Holmes returns. Of course, the suit looks immaculate on him, somehow transitioning him from freakish to elegant. His gaze, as it passes over the room and its inhabitants, no longer seems filled with childlike wonder, but piercing intelligence. "Clothes maketh the man." If John had been wearing a doctor's suit instead of his porter's uniform, then perhaps Costello wouldn't have looked at him like something that had just crawled out of the gutter. He gets up.
"Come on, we're going."
"Where?"
Holmes says.
"Back to my lodgings."
"No, you're not."
Missy has also got to her feet, her bag on her shoulder. you can come and stay with me. I have 3 bedrooms, so you can stay 2, John. Since you're unemployed now, you can keep an eye on him while I'm at work.
John stares at her. Part of him thinks,
3 bedrooms? How does a nurse working the night shift in a London hospital manage that? Are you okay with that?
She asks.
Yes.
John still can't quite believe it. I thought you were angry with me.
I am angry with you, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to help.
She smiles, and John's heart melts.
Thank you.
If you're sure.
Let's get a cab.
They pass out of the hospital doors and into the bright morning. Up on Westminster Bridge, dog carts and broughams and the occasional glossy black Lando take advantage of the clear day to whip up their horses, and the air is filled with the clatter of wheels, the rat-a-tat of hooves, and the cheerful cries of the drivers. On the other side of the river, the sun flashes off the remaining windows of the Houses of Parliament, and even the broken face of the clock seems to smile up at the blue sky. John can't remember the last time he saw such a lovely day. With his long legs, Holmes strides ahead, leaving John and Missy to walk together behind.
This is really good of you, he mutters, tentatively.
He looks at her sidelong to see if this too was the wrong thing to say.
Her eyes meet his, and she smiles a second time. Thanks for stopping Costello from firing me. I thought he was going to punch you.
John smiles ruefully. Actually, it was almost the other way round. I'd have liked to have taken him down a peg or two.
I'm glad you didn't. They don't have to wait long for a cab. The brougham clatters to a halt at the curb, the 2 horses in good condition, smelling of sweat and leather.
Where to? The driver calls down.
Baker Street, Missy says. They all climb inside, Holmes settling himself by the window and gazing downriver at the towering glass building stretching away to the east. John sits beside him, with Missy opposite, looking relaxed and carefree with the low sunlight filtering through the grimy glass. She has forgiven him for dragging her into this, and he is going to see her home. He has often wondered where she lives, and now he is keen to find out what it reveals. 3 bedrooms? That's still extraordinary.
The seats are well padded, and John feels pleasantly sleepy as they trundle over the bridge and up Whitehall, passing the endless monuments to the dead. The conflict in Afghanistan is just one of many that has been waged in the last decade. The soldiers used to joke that the only reason for the endless wars is to keep the arms dealers in business. And certainly it's true that nobody can quite explain what the fighting is all about. Sovereignty, protecting the borders, but nothing that will put food on the table. Holmes breaks the silence.
Do I have a first name?
John and Missy look at one another. John is too embarrassed to say it. Missy laughs.
Don't blame me. It was John's idea. It was the only one left in the book,
John protests.
Don't worry, Mr. Holmes. If you hate it, you can change it into something normal, like James or John.
A little too boring, Holmes remarks. John sniffs. Thanks. Holmes is looking at him, his eyes glinting.
So what is it?
John tells him. There's a beat of silence, then the pale man smiles.
Sherlock Holmes, he says.
Actually, I quite like it, Dr. Watson. And this time, John doesn't correct him. After all, he saved this man's life, so why not?
Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. That's how it'll be. The carriage rumbles on its way to Baker Street.